So first, now why is, there we go. First, a few words about the final exam. About 75% of the exam will be on this third section of the course, the democracy section. And about 25% will be harking back to the first two parts of the course. The questions on part three of the course, that is the part of the exam that covers the material since the midterm, those questions will be just like on the two midterms. There'll be a few statistics questions in the form of multiple choice, and the rest will be short answer, very much the same sort of questions you've already had. The questions which go back to parts one and two will only be about the big ideas of those sections. I won't ask any further questions about any of the graphs or figures. And it should be pretty clear, if you kind of go through your notes and go through the slides, which are the really prominent ideas. I'm not going to, in reviewing parts one and two, ask questions about, you know, second and third order details. They'll be about the major things that we talked about. Those questions really shouldn't be difficult, I think. Even without review, but if you spend some of your study time just reviewing the big ideas of the first two parts of the course, I think you'll have no trouble with that part of the final. All right, well, today we're discussing what, as I said at the end of last lecture, is probably the most controversial part of the topic of the course, the question of militarism. I think emotions, passions run really high around these issues because of what might be thought of as two faces of the military, two dimensions or aspects of the military as a social phenomenon. So let's think of this as a social phenomenon, not as something specific to the United States or any other country. On the one hand, individual soldiers who participate in war are asked to take enormous risks and make great sacrifices. These are real, and they're real whether or not one supports the objectives of the military. The demands on soldiers, the risks they take, the heroism they display, the fear they endure, the suffering that results in their lives and the lives of their families, those are real. And this means that there's very good reasons that the people in the military are seen as embodying important values and virtues: bravery, self-sacrifice, love of country. These are values that people care about. And they're, in a sense, symbolically embodied in the soldier in a way that's really quite special, quite distinctive. On the other hand, these great virtues can be in the service of terrible purposes. There's no reason whatsoever to think that the heroism and virtues of German soldiers or Japanese soldiers in World War II were any less than American soldiers. They were making sacrifices. Their families grieved when they were killed. They were brave or fearful, and so on. And yet, those virtues were in the service of terrible purposes. And that's the double side of the military. On the one hand, it embodies great virtue that is deserving of the deepest respect. And on the other hand, it's in the service of some of the most horrific catastrophes in history. If you were to kind of list what are the great catastrophes that can befall a society, the devastation of war certainly looms at the very top of the list. It's worse than the worst earthquakes, so to speak, the worst hurricanes. The devastation of war is worse than exploitation and inequality and domination. I mean, these are the most catastrophic things that can happen. sometimes there are pretty unambiguous moral purposes to which the military is in service. Sometimes it's pretty unambiguous. I think World War II is considered the kind of paradigm case. It's sometimes referred to as the good war, a war without the same kinds of moral ambiguities that one finds in many other wars in which the United States has been a participant. But there are times when there's really no clear case of good and evil. You know, even though propaganda may pose it that way, World War I is really like that. There was slaughter on both sides, and the purposes and goals of the war on both sides were pretty ambiguous. So this is the reason why I think war and warfare invokes such passion. Even when people die for in wars that do not serve a good purpose, they are treated as heroes. War memorials are sacred sites. And there's really a desperate need for people to believe that their family members, the death and destruction that occurred in war was not in vain. That expression is a classic expression that's connected to warfare. All this infuses discussions of the military with deep emotion and intensity. And in this course, the particular historical moment in which we live, this has become once again salient. As I think I mentioned in the opening lecture when I gave a sort of brief biography, so to introduce myself to you, this issue has played a very salient life and a very salient role in my own life. When I was your age, as an undergraduate, we were in the middle of the Vietnam War. And like many students of the era, I felt that war was profoundly immoral. That my country was engaging in mass destruction, causing the deaths of millions of people for no good purpose. There was uncertainty as to what the purposes really were. You know, there was debates even among critics as to what's really going on here. Why are we doing this terrible thing? Certainly I felt there was no ambiguity on the question of, was this a just war? I felt it wasn't. And therefore, as a student in my early 20s, graduating from college, I faced a problem, because in those days we had universal conscription. And I was healthy. I didn't have connections to powerful people to get out of it, like many current politicians of my generation. And I had to make a choice. I had friends who went to jail, who refused to serve, who couldn't get conscientious objector status and went to jail. I had another friend, at least one very close friend, who became an expatriate. He was actually, his name was Johnny Vequist. He was a childhood friend in Lawrence, Kansas when I was growing up. He went to West Point, was a commissioned officer, and defected to Sweden. He left his post because he felt the war was immoral and he just couldn't serve, and became an exile. I tried to get conscientious objector status, but in Kansas, where I grew up, you really had to show that you had a lifelong membership in a pacifist religion. That was the only grounds on which you could be given conscientious objector status. You couldn't object to a particular war as immoral. You had to prove that you objected to war as such, no matter what. And I wasn't a pacifist in that respect. I felt that fighting in World War II was justified. And certainly I believed if the United States was attacked by another country, we ought to defend ourselves. So I couldn't say, I'm not a pacifist. And then you couldn't refuse to serve in the army. Well, I did what some people did. I mean, I'm not saying that this was, quote, honorable. It didn't involve much, if any, self-sacrifice. I enrolled in a religious seminary and was studying for the ministry, because you could get a deferment if you did that. It was a fantastic experience. I mean, I gained a lot from those studies. I don't regret it at all. But it was not what one would call a heroic response. It was a way out because of the beliefs I held. Well, so I also, therefore, have intense feelings about these issues. I had to make life choices because of my particular views about the military. Not the military as an abstract idea, my views about the military in that particular historical moment. Well, so I know this is contentious, and I imagine that there are some of you who may be vets from the current international conflicts. Certainly some of you who may be either planning to or already enlisted for future service. So what I'm giving you then is a general perspective on the character of the military in American society. Why this is a very salient dimension of our national social structure. It's a feature of American society that's quite distinctive in the world today, the role of the military. Give you an historical perspective about it, and some sense of the ramifications for our society as a whole of having such a prominent role for the military. The conventional view by Americans about war and peace and the United States, I think, is something like this. That we use our military power to defend freedom, to defend democracy, to protect America, but not to dominate other countries. We are defenders, not aggressors. There are war-making, aggressive, nasty powers in the world, countries which oppress their own people and threaten others. That's a fact of life that exists. We oppose them. We have a Department of Defense, not a Department of War. We use our military power, therefore, for positive purposes. That, I think, is the standard, if somewhat oversimplified. People may have a little bit of typical hesitations about that, but I think that's pretty much the standard view. Not merely a positive view of soldiers, of the personnel of the military, we support our troops as people, but a positive role view of the role of the military. Well, here is at least pieces of the reality. We spend vastly more than any other country in the world on the military. We use military threats and intervention as a central instrument of foreign policy, including using the military directly and indirectly to overthrow democratically elected governments. We have used the military to intervene in governments not simply to overthrow dictatorships, but to overthrow constitutionally elected democratic governments as well. Our domestic affairs are severely affected by the global role of our military. We have what could be called a heavily militarized economy. It's not just that this military affects our foreign policy and it's somehow cordoned off from the rest of the society. We have what I think can only be described as a militarized economy. Well, let me just give you a few statistics. Again, I haven't updated these because of my circumstances, but the basic contours of these statistics are valid for the present as well. In the United States, roughly half of the total spending on the military in the entire world comes from the United States. A little bit less than half of the total global spending on the military is American. This is a map of the world showing countries in which we have bases around the world. These maps and figures and stuff, they're also in the book, so you don't have to take notes. During the heyday of the British Empire, there was the slogan, "The sun never sets on the British Empire." We can say the sun never sets on American bases. There is always an American base somewhere in the world in daylight. Here is a partial list, I think. I'm not sure. I can't say for sure if it's 100%, but it's a list of U.S. military interventions between 1945 and 2010. And the ones in yellow are the ones where the United States troops were directly involved. That is where we sent troops to particular places. The bottom one got cut off. No matter, it's in the book. You see there's lots and lots of countries there, and some of these at various times were interventions to overthrow elected governments, not just governments that were authoritarian. This final graph shows the military spending as a proportion of federal spending in 2009. Again, the figures will be a little different now. They went down a bit, and it looks like they're going to go up again in the next years. If you include interest from past wars as part of military spending, which seems appropriate, that is, if you have to borrow money to pay for military activities, then the interest payments on those loans, that part of the federal deficit that comes from the military, the interest payments on that should be included in the cost of military. So it comes to a bit less than half of our national budget of federal spending. That seems like a pretty militarized state, if you ask me, one that spends roughly half of its budget on military and military-related issues. I like to think of this type of configuration where a country places such a role of the military in its domestic, in the use of its resources, and in projecting and using military power as a way of dealing with various kinds of international conflicts in which it's engaged, the term that captures that configuration is militarism. Well, what is militarism? Here is a definition. Militarism is a political and ideological orientation towards international affairs in which, first, the threat and use of military power is a central strategy of international policy. Second, the military plays a pervasive role in the internal economic and political life of a country. To call a configuration militarist, it has to have significant ramifications for the internal political and economic life of a country, not just its foreign affairs. Military preparedness is the highest priority of government policy. It preempts everything else. So it's number one on the list. You take care of that, and then what's left over, you worry about other things. And the implication of this, and this is an important idea, militarism is not a policy, it's an institution. It's a chronic feature of contemporary American society, deeply embedded in our economic, political, and social institutions. To say it's an institution, not a policy, means that it creates a very broad range of interests, of corporations, of workers in particular sectors, of politicians, of military personnel and others. It creates a whole set of interlocking interests that depend upon each other and which are dependent on militarism. It is a system. We call something an institution where the interests of the various participants interlock in a way that reproduces the stability of the system itself. Militarism is an institution, it's a system. The intensity may vary over time, but it is broadly defended by both major political parties. Militarism is not a Republican or Democratic affair. In recent times, it has tended to be pushed more relentlessly by Republicans, but that's really just a matter of degree. No Democratic politician of any prominent stature, no sort of major Democratic figures, have opposed American militarism. When base closings occur, Democratic politicians defend the existence of bases. When there's a big military contract for some extravagant new weapon that affects their constituents, they defend those military contracts. This is not a Republican versus Democratic issue. It's a national question. Well, let me give you a brief kind of historical trajectory around American militarism. So this is a very simplified, stripped down history of militarism, but I think it'll capture the central dynamics and tendencies. First, the founding fathers and the early republic. At the founding of the United States, there was great skepticism about the military and the use of military power for national objectives. There was widespread objection to the idea of a standing army. George Washington said in his farewell address, "Overgrown military establishments are, under any form of government, inauspicious to liberty and are to be regarded as particularly hostile to Republican liberty." The farewell address in 1796. Just as an historical footnote, an anecdote, the famous Second Amendment to the Constitution, the right to bear arms, was specifically a right to bear arms so you could have a well-maintained militia, a citizen's militia, not a standing army. It wasn't the right to bear arms for your own personal use and protection. That's not what the amendment says. It says in order to establish a well-ordered, I think, militia, some words of that sort, the right to bear arms shall not be abridged. That should be thought of not merely as a right to bear arms, but as an indictment of standing armies. The Second Amendment is an amendment opposed to the idea of a permanent professional standing army, in favor of citizens' militias. James Madison, our fair city, named after this president, wrote, "Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other, that is, every other enemy to public liberty. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies, debt, and taxes are the known instrument for bringing the many under the domination of the few." And nearly 200 years later, Eisenhower affirmed the same worry. "This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence of the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist, and we must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted." I think it's worth just hearing a brief excerpt from Eisenhower's speech. I'm gonna trip over this.
This time, and as required, the soldiers as well. But it can no longer as the emergency and policy of national defense. have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Had to do this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense of such. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new to the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need of this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the Council of the Government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwanted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizen can compare the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial movement.
Okay. So it's not just kind of left-wing anti-military critics of the present who were skeptical about the role of the military in American society, and particularly about this problem of militarism, about the military having this inordinate standing within public policy and within the national economy. This was a concern that was present right from the start, and should be therefore thought as an organic concern within American history, not simply a kind of external criticism of particular policies. How did we get, therefore, from the 18th century, where George Washington and the other founding fathers opposed the very idea of a standing army, how did we get to that? From there to a situation where the United States spends close to 50% of the global spending on the military, and it takes up 45% plus or minus of our own national government budget. How did we get from that early state to the present? Well, here then is a kind of brief history. Is that, can you read that okay? Even though it's light, it's okay, okay. Yeah. As I said, I prefer to have a brightly lit room, even if it makes the PowerPoints a little dimmer. So first, the 19th century, I think we could say, broadly speaking, as a kind of first approximation, in the 19th century there was quite a lot of ambivalence about standing armies. The worry about standing armies was real, but it confronted another core American idea, which strengthened in the course of the 19th century. The importance of of military power for the conquest of the lands of North America. This became crystallized under the expression manifest destiny. It was our destiny to be a country from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. Military power was essential for displacing Native Americans in the expansion to the West. And this should not be thought of as merely protecting settlers as defensive. It was an offensive move to displace Native Americans, as was the Mexican War of 1848. This was a war of invasion and conquest. Texas and California, New Mexico, Arizona, these territories belong to the United States, not because of simple movement of peoples westward to unincorporated territories. No, this was the result of a war of invasion and conquest, whose purpose was the acquisition of territory. That's, I think, generally the general consensus of historians these days. There was a time, particularly with the kind of myth of Davy Crockett and the Alamo, in which the American invasion of the Mexican territories in the western part of the United States was seen as defensive, protecting American settlers who had moved into those territories, protecting them from oppression by the Mexican government. But that's really a complete distortion of that history. The history is actually in some ways even more displaced, unpleasant. One of the causes of the Mexican War was that the Mexican government was not allowing slavery in Texas. And the Americans who had moved to the Texas part of Mexico wanted to bring slaves there. In a funny, in this sort of strange and perverted way, the Mexican War was the beginning of the Civil War. I mean, I think that's an overstatement, because it was broadly supported by the North as well as the South. But it was impelled, the reason why it occurred when it occurred was to a significant extent because of the issue of slavery and the desire to expand slavery westward. The Spanish-American War at the end of the 19th century was really the first instance that launched U.S. militarism on a global scale. The Civil War, of course, was a great military confrontation, but after the Civil War, there was largely demobilization. It basically went back to the status quo ante, in which the U.S. military was primarily being used for purposes of aggression in the western parts of the United States against Native Americans. The Civil War did not really begin a process by which the U.S. military became a global military. That really began with the Spanish-American War. The Spanish-American War included what can really only be called imperialist suppression of a conquered people. In the Philippines, there was sharp resistance to the American occupation. The Filipino population was indeed happy to get rid of the Spanish in the Spanish-American War. They were rebelling against the Spanish rule in the Philippines. But after the American defeat of Spain in the Spanish-American War, the United States occupied the Philippines, with the resulting of approximately 200,000 Filipinos being killed during the 1901 to 1903 repression. That, I think, can only be thought of as a colonial war of imperial suppression, just like what the British did in parts of Africa and elsewhere, just like the Belgians did in the Congo, just like European powers were doing in various places. It was a war of conquest and repression. It was ideologically defended on racial and cultural grounds. It's a kind of irony of American history that the Japanese used the same arguments that the United States used in its invasion of the Philippines, that the United States used when it invaded the Philippines in 1901. The Japanese used it in its invasion of the Philippines 40 years later, that this was, they defended this on the grounds of great nations having the right to occupy and civilize the peoples of less developed parts of the world. Before the Spanish-American War, the American army was pretty amateurish. It was pretty disorganized. It did not have what could be thought of as a modern bureaucratic structure. It was professional. People were public employees. They were paid. But it did not have all the trappings of a well-organized, administratively competent institution. The Spanish-American War was really the turning point for that. And in the period leading up to World War I, there occurred the first efforts to seriously bureaucratize and modernize the army. World War I then really does constitute the decisive turning point in the formation of a substantial and sustained modernized military. The Spanish-American War, in a sense, launched the effort for the American military to be expansive, to be outward-looking, not just inward-looking. Even the Spanish, even the Mexican War, which was an aggression against a foreign power, was an aggression for purposes of acquiring territory for the United States. And in that particularly narrow sense, it was less of an international vision for the military than has occurred in the 20th century. And the Spanish-American War is a kind of bridge between that earlier domestic use of the military for consolidating a national territory, manifest destiny, to the present global role for the U.S. military. World War I also is characterized by the beginnings of what has become a standard feature of American use of military, which Chalmers Johnson refers to as ideological crusades. World War I was fought under slogans that had a high moral purpose, making the world safe for democracy. That was one of the slogans of World War I, and the war to end all wars. World War I was really the first war that was so strongly fought under a banner of very high moral principle. After World War I, there was a substantial demilitarization. At that point, 1918, when the war ended, there was still not an impulse to turn from having a professional military capable of fighting in international wars to having a militarized economy. In the 20s and the 30s, until the run-up to World War II, the American economy remained largely separate from the military. World War II and the Cold War really changed that. Ideological crusades became a permanent feature of American foreign policy, and militarism became a central feature of both foreign policy and the domestic economy. World War II was the greatest military mobilization in American history. It remains the iconic vision of what the United States is capable of. Our general self-understanding is that we won the war, that it was the American military forces that were the decisive players in this global conflict. And while it is certainly unquestionable that the United States played a crucial role in the global victory over Japan and Germany, on the European war, good arguments can be made that the Soviet army was actually the decisive military force that defeated the Nazis. In Japan, the United States played the crucial role. After World War II, there was an expectation of demilitarization. The initial expectation was that just as after World War I, there was a disengagement of the economy from the military and a dramatic demilitarization of public policy as well as the economy. That was also expected after World War II. But the Cold War, which emerged in the late 1940s as the global conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, really ended that. The result has been more than 70 years now, maybe more than 65 years, not quite 70, of military budgets in current dollars that have always been over $300 billion a year and often over $400 billion. Here is a graph of, in 2009 dollars, of Department of Defense budget. The Department of Defense budget is less than the total spending on the military because the interest on previous wars isn't part of the Defense Department's budget. And then there are various other kinds of military spending which occurs in the form of, for example, military foreign aid, which doesn't come under the rubric of the Defense Department. But still, roughly speaking, one can see this as the ebbs and flows of American military spending over the last 60 years or so. The effects of 70 years of interventions in military spending. Defense contracts are the single most important way that the government intervenes in the economy, providing jobs, research, technical change, economic stimulation. The livelihoods of millions of Americans depend upon military spending. And that's really important to recognize. When we increase military spending by the proposed $54 billion, that's currently the plan of the current administration, that means jobs, that means contracts, that means profits. It's a form of state intervention in the economy. Ultimately, the sustainability of that level of military spending depends on war. In the absence of war, it is almost impossible to maintain over a very long period of time huge military spending. So that's a kind of paradox. You expand military spending in the name of defense. You lock in a set of interests that have an interest in the spending as such, regardless of its need. And those interests can be satisfied only by the maintenance of high levels of spending, which itself requires military interventions. That's why this becomes a system that's very dicey in terms of its kind of moral texture. Massive military spending inevitably, or I suppose one should say almost inevitably, just to give a little wiggle room, but massive military spending almost inevitably breeds corruption. Because military spending is shrouded in secrecy, under the shield of national security and classified information, it is almost impossible to have adequate monitoring of military spending. And in the bigger contrast, there's virtually no real competition. There are so few companies which can really bid for jobs for some of these massively expensive projects. And thus military contracts are chronically plagued with inflated prices and huge amounts of fraud. In the early 2000s, the Inspector General of the Pentagon reported that something like $1 trillion of spending that was on the Pentagon's books could not be traced. They couldn't figure out. The Inspector General, whose job is to check the books on things, he could not trace exactly where all the spending went. And scandals are frequent. During the Iraq War, there were tremendous scandals about Hal Burton and its use of military contracts and its inflation of prices. But this is just the latest in a long line of such pillaging of the public purse. And again, because everything is shrouded in secrecy, it's extremely hard to have satisfactory monitoring. Unlike the monitoring of civilian projects, you have a highway project, you can check the books, it's all open, you can see the extent to which there are kickbacks, to the extent to which there are inflated prices. For giant military projects of building aircraft carriers and new generations of airplanes, it's basically virtually impossible to have rigorous monitoring, because monitoring requires transparency. What about the 21st century? After the Cold War, there was much talk again about a peace dividend. So just as after World War I, there was demilitarization and a disengagement of the military from the economy, and after World War II, this was hoped for but was blocked by the Cold War. At the end of the Cold War, the early 90s, there was great talk of a peace dividend. And there was the hope that the peace dividend could be used for such things as a rebuilding of American infrastructure, which remains a serious problem today. 9/11 and the war on terrorism really ended that discussion. And indeed, the 2000s have led to, if anything, a significant intensification of previous militarism because of the open-ended and ill-defined character of the war on terrorism as a source of threat that justifies a permanent war economy. This reinvigoration of the military has been backed by a pretty extreme doctrine of the supremacy of American military might and the right of the United States to decide on its own when and where to intervene in the world on the basis of our views rather than on the basis of some consensus among other countries, our views of what's in our national interest. It's one thing to place one's national interests at the center of defense, that is, saying we have the right to protect our borders from attack and have an uncompromising view that that's nobody's business but ours to defend ourselves. And another thing to say that it is nobody's business but ours to use our military power to intervene wherever we want, under whatever conditions we choose. Well, that is a kind of brief, if stripped down, account of the historical trajectory of militarism. How do we explain it? What are the motivations for militarism today? And this raises the problem of what some people call empire, in which they characterize American militarism as really the sort of militarism that you would associate normally with an imperial power, a power that wants to dominate globally, not merely protect itself from global threats. There really is no single overriding motive, I think, that explains militarism. I don't think it can be reduced to some simple singular goal. Most pervasive, durable features of social systems are supported through complex combinations of interests and motivations rather than some single overriding goal. And again, this is what it means to say that militarism is an institution. It's a stable institution and becomes self-perpetuating precisely because of the multiplicity of interests and motivations that support militarism and mutually reinforce each other, and are themselves reproduced by militarism itself. So you get a kind of feedback loop. Militarism creates a diverse set of interests. All of those interests coalesce and have an interest in reproducing militarism, so it's strengthened, which then reinforces those interests. You get and that renders it a stable system. So what I want to do then is chart out what is this multiplicity of motivations. I think some of these are more central than others, but the main point is not to identify what's the primary explanation, what's the primary cause or motivation for militarism, but rather to see how the system works, how these different interests interlock and reinforce each other. First, there is the question of just narrow economic interests. The U.S. uses military power sometimes to defend quite narrow and specific economic interests. In the present period, this is especially important for oil. It's, you know, if you imagine the conflicts occurring in the Middle East occurred in some other place without such vital resources, let's say the center of Africa, the United States would be much less concerned about its involvement. And indeed, there has been warfare going on in the central part of Africa in which many hundreds of thousands more people have been killed. The great war of the Congo and the central regions of Africa has been vastly more destructive. It's a war on historic proportions in terms of life lost. And the United States hasn't felt any need to intervene. And the reason isn't that the powers involved in the African conflict don't have weapons of mass destruction. It turned out Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction either. It's because there are no stakes, no economic interests, no resources that matter. It's an oversimplification, but it's certainly the case that a good deal of our military interventions in the last 15 years occurred in areas where we have interests in oil. Here's a map, again, a little bit out of date, but a map that was produced during the period of the Iraq War, which shows the relationship between the areas where there are oil. So this is 1989, in terms of where we had military bases. This is 1991, 1999, 2001, and 2003. And as you can see, the additional bases are occurring substantially in regions where there are oil. So a second motivation, the maintenance of global economic dominance of American-based multinational corporations. That's not quite the same as saying the United States is intervening because of a specific economic interest. The United States intervened in Nicaragua in the 1920s on behalf of United Fruit to prevent the expropriation of United Fruit properties. So the United States intervenes in sometimes in places specifically because of particular economic interests. But more broadly, then, it's argued that American global military presence is important to maintain the global economic dominance of American-based multinational corporations. American-based corporations make investments all over the world. American military power has been sometimes used to open up markets for these corporations, to prevent governments from interfering too much with those investments, to basically safeguard the world economy for corporate investment. The idea here is then that if we want to have a world where capitalist investment can smoothly function globally, it's important for powers around the world to know that we will use our military power in order to protect those markets. If you put the first two motivations together, narrow economic interests and the maintenance of global economic dominance, those two together are often referred to as imperialism. So when you hear people criticize American foreign policy and criticize the use of American military under that rubric, if you say the United States is acting as an imperialist power, and this is imperialism, it's some combination of the first two motivations. The third motivation is national security, and this certainly is an important motivation. I think it's a mistake that sometimes is made by critics of American foreign policy to imagine that national security plays no role, or that it in fact is not a serious issue. Few people deny the relevance of an effective national defense in a world in which there are other powers that have military capacities. However, there's a deep disagreement about whether militarism as such is mainly a matter of defense rather than the aggressive pursuit of national interests. There are occasionally American politics. Rand Paul, for example, a libertarian politician, who argues that we really should only use our military for national defense, and who has argued that we should remove all American bases abroad. Have none. No American bases abroad. That's a surefire way to make it hard for the United States to intervene aggressively anywhere. You can't use your military for purposes of overthrowing governments and nation building and securing our interests in foreign places. You can't use it very effectively if you don't have bases around the world. And Rand Paul, the Republican, has argued that we should simply dismantle our foreign bases and have a military that is strong enough for defending our borders, but not strong in ways that enable us to advance our interests globally. And I think that would, personally, on that particular policy, I'm all with Rand Paul. I think he probably has among the most sensible views of the military of anybody in the US Senate, precisely because he is opposed to the use of military for purposes in support of corporate and other interests abroad. So the national security is an issue, but militarism extends far beyond any, I think, reasonable diagnosis of where our national security needs lie. In the Cold War, anti-militarists and anti-imperialists argued that strengthening international institutions and cooperations would actually be better for defense. So there is this view, which I think has at least some significant merits, that militarism actually harms national security. So it's not just that it's using our military for purposes of national security plus something else, but this highly aggressive interventionist stand with that long list of ways in which places we've used our military power for intervention actually weakens national security. It's certainly the case in the Iraq War that one can hardly make the case that our national security has been strengthened by the destabilization of the Middle East that's occurred in the aftermath of American intervention. And more generally, I think this posture means that we don't pursue other ways of creating more international cooperation and integration, which from the strict point of view of what's in our best interest for national security, arguably would do a better job. Fourth, there are the distinctive interests of the military-industrial complex itself. This is the lock-in problem, the problem about how you create clusters of interests that all reinforce each other in a particular policy, irrespective of the purposes for which that policy serves. It's like the point I made about private prisons. You create corporations, for-profit corporations, who make their money by housing prisoners. And what you do is you create a powerful lobbying group that has a positive interest in crime. It's, you know, kind of weird to say it that way. I'm not saying that the Prison Corporation of America actually goes out and pays criminals to commit crimes so that we can lock them up. No, I'm not suggesting that it does things so as to increase crime itself, but it does have an interest in being as tough on crime as possible because that's what generates its revenues. You have constituencies then that have an interest in militarism. Cuts in military programs hurt powerful corporations, workers, and communities. They hurt ordinary people. The result is that military contractors form a coalition with regional politicians and workers whose jobs are threatened by reductions in military spending, and they fight for military budgets, and that helps keep the military budgets high. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that the level of military spending that's caused by that lobbying is the same as the military spending that's required by our needs of national security. It would be kind of a miracle, right? Sort of a fantasy, if all the interests that care about spending as much as possible because that's where they make their money happen to demand exactly the right level of military spending for purposes of providing us with national security. It's just not plausible that these two levels of spending coincide, and you can imagine which one is likely to be higher. The level of military spending that's most satisfactory for those corporations, workers, regions, politicians, and communities that are most dependent on military spending, that the level of military spending that's optimal for them is much higher than the level of military spending that's optimal for the society understood in terms of our national security. And again, to justify such budgets, you need threats. Exaggerating threats, creating a culture of fear, thus is a constant strategy to maintain military spending. So let's just take the last 15 years or so. Terrorism is something to be afraid of. It is a horrible fact of the contemporary world that there are people prepared to commit suicide in ways that destroy the lives of many others. So terrorism is definitely fearful. But is it as serious a source of harm and threat to the lives of people as, let's say, the Zika virus, or other, you know, mosquito-borne diseases, or cancer, so that we should displace funding for cancer research to military spending in order to prevent deaths from terrorism and not put research into curing cancer, or global warming? I mean, if you ask what are the threats to life for which public policy could make a difference, it's true, terrorism is one, but there's lots of others. The exaggeration of the danger and threat posed by terrorism, however, serves some really good purposes if you're a corporation whose revenues come from military spending. To justify budgets, you need threats. Exaggerating threats is a constant strategy. It's a strategy. That's what you have to keep in mind. This is a strategy. It isn't just that the fear of terrorism is a spontaneous response of people to the number of acts that occur and their assessment weighing of the probabilities that they would be vulnerable to a terrorist attack. No, it's a strategy. It's played up. It's used as a way of persuading people to support such large budgets. Finally, as a motivation for militarism, there is the issue of ideological crusades. The precise character of the crusade changes from time to time, but its core is the belief that the United States has a divine mission to spread its values and ways of life around the world, not just because this is in our narrow national interests, but because it is the right thing to do. Or even stronger, sometimes a religious invocation. We are doing God's work by extending our institutions globally. Now, this is how the Bush administration put it during the Iraq War. There is a single sustainable model for national success that is right and true for every person in every society. The United States must defend liberty and justice because these principles are right and true for all people everywhere. Those then are the five motivations. They come in different mixes, different weights. I don't have any way of giving centrality for one or the other. I think it's the configuration of these interests that's the crucial, and that the crucial factor, the crucial way to understand this, and that's what explains how robust the militarist establishment is in the United States. The consequences of militarism, briefly. First, perpetual war. Constant development of new technologies to reduce U.S. casualties and make interventions even easier, even though these may increase what we euphemistically call collateral damage. Now, it's absolutely understandable and clearly desirable if the military is used only for purposes of defense, to develop technologies which minimize the casualties of your soldiers. It's a little more problematic, though, when you really think about it in the long term, of minimizing the casualties to your own soldiers if you're going to use that military power for aggressive purposes. Because it makes aggression easier, less costly, less politically dangerous. But of course, you can't say we want our soldiers to be more vulnerable. Of course not. That's a ridiculous thing to propose for a military. No military wants to make its soldiers more vulnerable. Although I recently heard, I saw a PBS thing on World War I, in which in World War I, the American military didn't allow its pilots to have parachutes, whereas the German military did. And the reason was they were afraid that they would parachute out too quickly. They wouldn't stay in the fight. So American pilots had a higher casualty rate in World War I than the French or British or German Air Force. They weren't Air Forces, the Air Corps of the Army. I didn't know that until, and it's a strange factoid of American military history. So perpetual war. We develop these new technologies. We have our aggressive interventionist posture provokes reactions in response to our interventions. This is sometimes called blowback. Terrorism was in part a response to militarism. Not only, but in part. The terrorism in turn then provides justification for further intervention in militarism. You get a vicious cycle, perpetual war. Reduction of democracy at home. Increasing concentration of power in the presidency is one of the hallmarks of militarism. The president can bring us to war virtually on his own initiative. Military priorities are bolstered by fear, and people are more willing to give up civil liberties when they are afraid. The Patriot Act is an example. The Patriot Act would never have passed Congress if people weren't scared after 9/11. Militarism is at the center of what can be called the politics of fear. And the politics of fear makes people behave in much more conservative and authoritarian ways. Militarism also preempts other forms of state spending and curtails the scope of democratic deliberation about the public good. And finally, militarism undermines what could be thought of as a democratic political culture. In debates over domestic priorities, people can see their opponents as legitimate opponents and can seek compromises. When you're just engaged in political fights over domestic priorities. In a militarized context of debates over war and security, opponents are often treated like traitors. It gets much heavier, much more politically polarized when the issues in play center around military. And that undermines democracy. The degradation of information, that's another consequence of militarism. Information warfare and deception become official policy. The war in Iraq was a stunning example of this. Lies and deception became routine policy of the Iraq war, most notoriously in the initial justification of the war on the grounds that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. But this was also true in the Vietnam War. The Gulf of Tonkin Revolution, which is resolution, which was a congressional resolution that authorized the massive escalation of the war in Vietnam, was known at the time by the intelligence community as a fake, that it wasn't true, that we had not been attacked. It was made up for purposes of justifying the war. When combined with the problems of corporate control over the media, prolonged militarism creates a deep crisis of information. You just don't know what to believe. And finally, endless militarism poses the problem of national bankruptcy. There's a looming economic catastrophe in the United States as our national debt increases massively under the pressure of military spending, especially when combined with massive tax cuts, which is, it's from an economic point of view, a crazy thing to do, to have massive tax cuts combined with massive increases in military spending. This debt is held to a significant extent by foreign governments. And the enormous trade deficit, characteristic of American international relations, further places us in a precarious position. It is really only the global power of the United States that prevents this debt load from crashing down as it has in other countries, Argentina or Russia. But This cannot go on forever. You cannot indefinitely have a massive expansions of military spending maintained at very high levels, which necessarily have to be paid for out of deficits because of the impossibility of having tax revenues capable of covering that level of militarism. And ultimately, this leads to an unsustainable debt. Okay. That's it for militarism. On Wednesday, we will discuss unions and democracy. See you then.